This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Thank you, and welcome to the celebration. Wow, thanks very much for all of you thousands of listeners who are out there listening to the Magic Word Podcast week after week. We have reached number 600. This is it. Thank you so very much for helping to make it to this point in our life of the podcast. So this is fantastic. Oh, golly, I'm just so happy to be here, and I hope that you enjoy being here week after week also. Again, we couldn't be here if you guys didn't support us and come and listen and tell all of your friends, and oh my gosh, I'm just so excited. So much fun. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast.com. In case you didn't know who this was, that you're just tuning in and listening for the first time, this is a good one to get started because we have just a wonderful guest this week, Mr. Max Maven, formerly known as Phil Goldstein. That's why I called the title of this podcast Phil to Max, because he was Phil and then became Max Maven. But also, he's filling our brain to the max. I mean, he's just got so much information and good advice. And whenever you're around him and you listen to his lectures or just hear me speak like you will here in this week's podcast, you just kind of feel like your brain is going to explode, but you have to go back and get some more. Go back to the fire hydrant and try and put out that fire, because this is hot. This is a good one. And I'm so glad that we had an opportunity to sit down with my good friend Max Maven for this week. He had just turned 70 years old here recently. With that, he has just 70 years of knowledge or more. I would probably say a lot more because of how much research and study and book learning and everything else that he has done over the years and can share with everybody, because he's such a good and giving guy. And I know that you're going to enjoy it. I really don't want to tell you too much more about this episode because you will just enjoy it as it unfolds. I certainly did. We just went in different directions, and I think you'll enjoy every nook and cranny we explore. So please welcome this week, my friend, my guest here for this 600th episode, Mr. Max Maven, here on The Magic Word. Well, today I have with me someone whose name is familiar with all of the magic community worldwide, has been around for quite some time. In fact, just recently had celebrated his 70th birthday here on Earth, and I'm just pleased to have him here with us because he is not only just a magician, but also a mentalist, and perhaps you might know him best as being that mentalist, considered erudite and intelligent, and indeed he is. He's ranked one of the most influential mentalists of all time, and one of the most influential magicians of the 20th century, the Magic Magazine had said of him. He had resided initially in Boston, Massachusetts, lived in Rome for a while, and a lot of his TV shows are interactive and mind-reading types of tricks. He's a prolific author and reader. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Conceived a lot of different magic and mentalist effects and has been consulting for people like Siegfried and Roy, Penn and Teller, David Copperfield, etc., etc. A frequent contributor to all kinds of magazines. You name a magic magazine, or even those you can't even think of that he has contributed for, and has authored many magazine or books, as well as being on the cover of 30 magic magazines over the years, and I've been on television and just everything else. So please welcome my friend here today, Mr. Max Maven. Hello, Max.
Hi there. That's quite the introduction. I'm not sure I can live up to it.
Well, I didn't go into all of the awards and things that you had won, such as the Creative Fellowship of the Academy of Magical Arts. I remember when we were at the Mindvention, you had gotten the Lifetime Achievement Award. When was that, back in 2015 or something? But most recently, the Alan Slade Award. That's pretty impressive, the Alan Slade Award.
Well, the Alan Slade Award is something unusual in the world of magic. Because it's not only a great honor, but it comes with money,
right?
Which is certainly more than appreciated. The Slade Awards have been now, I think it's 6 years that they've been doing them, and I believe it's five awards each year, slightly different amounts of money for different people based on what the award is. And in my case, it was a lifetime achievement award. I'm not sure that was actually the precise wording, but that was the gist of it. And it's nice to have some lifetime left in which to enjoy the accolade.
Absolutely. Like you were saying on your 70th birthday, that people were wishing you another 70 years, and you were saying,
I don't think I could stand another 70, but I'll take it for more.
Well, we'd like to have you around for another 70 years with your advice and your direction that you've helped us with so many different things. And speaking of the awards, there was another one. I remember that James Randi had one. It seems like that came, it was a fellowship that came like with $250,000 or something. Remember what I'm talking about?
Well, that was not a magic award per se. Right. That was a MacArthur grant.
That was it.
And the MacArthur grants are given, they're referred to as genius awards. Mm-hmm. And basically they find people in a wide range of activities, from the sciences to literature to various art forms and everything else in between, and just pick people and say, we're going to give you enough money. And I don't know if it's always the same amount, but it's always a large amount of money. Mm-hmm. And we're going to give you enough money that you don't have to worry about financing what it is you do. You can just keep doing it for a while, which is a splendid idea. And there have been a few people connected to magic who've received MacArthur grants. I know, for example, Michael Motion, the brilliant, innovative juggler, received a MacArthur grant some years ago. Hmm. And then there are other people in the entertainment field.
Has Percy Dikonis won that?
I think he did, based on his work as in statistics. So again, a connection to the magic world,
right?
But not being given for magic activity.
Right. Again, in that case, you said there were several different people each year, much like the Slate Award, I guess, that they have different people.
Yeah, I don't. The difference would be that the Slate Award has five specific categories. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you what they are, although I can't give you the formal titles off the top of my head.
Right.
There's a Rising Star Award given to someone young and creating an impact. There's a specific Canadian Rising Star Award. Because Alan Slate is from Canada. Mm-hmm. Then there's an award for literature. There's or creativity in published and sharing of ideas. And there is an award for performing. And then finally, there is this lifetime award.
Right.
And so those are very specific categories. As far as I understand it, in the MacArthur grants, there are no specific categories. It's just we think you're a genius, therefore,
right?
Please underwrite what you're doing.
Well, I think you're a genius, certainly, and that's why I wanted to have you here as my guest for this episode number 600. I didn't want to wait until number 666 because I remember that Jeannie had already done that for you, and there was a little controversy about that.
No. When Jeannie hit its 666th issue, at that time, the editor was Dante Larson. Mm-hmm. And Dante, in a moment of sort of dark humor, said, let's do a special issue on 666 where it'll all be kind of satanically themed, but in a humorous way.
Yeah.
And that was done. I was involved in writing a couple of the pieces for that issue. It got some very angry feedback.
Mm-hmm. I remember.
From people who were upset about the connection to devil stuff. Ignoring, first of all, that it was done with humor. But secondly, devils are part and parcel of magic. Mm-hmm. If you're offended, then you shouldn't be sticking around in the magic world. If you look at the imagery on magicians' posters and magic dealers' advertisements, the number of devils and imps and demons who show up is so widespread that it would be easier to name the magicians who didn't have devils on their posters.
It's legion, so to speak.
Yes, exactly. to turn the phrase. So There is not a theological aspect to the use of devil imagery on magic posters. It's kind of a tradition in the Western world to link magic with dark forces. There have been times when that link has been more serious than now. I would think that now most people don't think that theatrical conjuring is somehow connected to the netherworld. Although there are some. I saw a video on YouTube a year or so back, and it was a long video, it was over an hour, where someone had taken all sorts of performances of magic from television. So David Copperfield, Penn and Teller, I don't remember exactly who was on this, but there was a commentary on this. And each of these performers was linked to Satanism and evil. And this person believed that what they were seeing was real, literal, supernatural evil.
Wow.
So I guess such people still exist. I don't think there are a lot of them. I hope there aren't.
Kind of like flat earthers, I guess, basically. Kind of.
Yeah, something.
Yeah. I remember that for a short time, the Banachek had some posters, and what he had were aliens on his shoulders, because people believe that aliens are coming and giving us these different brilliant ideas and things, or that they are much more intelligent, and perhaps they whispered in his ear. Yeah, I thought that was kind of funny, but it never seemed to take off.
Years ago, this is going to be over 30 years ago, I did an engagement in a relatively small city in South Dakota, and I was brought in to do a small nightclub that had just, it was a restaurant that had just converted into having live performance. And when I arrived, the woman who owned the club said, "I've set up a radio interview for you this afternoon so that you can go onto the radio and explain that you're not a Satanist."
Wow.
Because people had reacted purely to my appearance, to my image, and the fact that the advertisements for this little club said, you know, mentalist or mind reader or whatever phrase they used. And there had been some upset in this town. So I went on the radio and said, "Hi, I'm an entertainer. I'm not friends with the devil." We're barely passing acquaintances.
Yeah, I had done a show in some place. I flew into Birmingham, Alabama, and I had to drive like 2 hours someplace out in the hills, and it was for a company party, and I remember doing a card trick, and then it was like a rising card of some sort. Anyhow, when I asked the person what the name of the card was, they just said, "I don't know, we don't play cards out here. We don't, you know, that's kind of the devil." It's like, I looked around, and did anybody else remember the card? And they all kind of said, "Nope, we don't." It's like, okay, now I understand. I should have figured this out before I got here.
Yeah, I know of performers who have done shows for groups that, for religious reasons, do not play cards, and they've reconfigured some of their material that would ordinarily be done with playing cards to be done with alphabet cards, for example. So it's not the physical cards themselves that are outlawed. It's playing cards as we know them.
Yeah, specifically because they have some meaning, perhaps, or something. I invented a variation shuffleboard using children's alphabet, not alphabet cards, but cards like with a ball and a bird and different kinds of things on that. Yeah. So whenever that you flip through this book that I made, that it was all the things that the child would select would start with a B except for one, which was an ice cream cone or something like that. So it can be certainly revised without using playing
cards. There seems
to
be always a way to do a workaround, not only terms of playing cards, but in terms of almost anything else in magic. One of the interesting things about magic to me is that it's very flexible.
Right.
If you approach it with the idea of flexibility, you'll find it.
Well, that leads into a question I'm sure that you've been asked many times in the past, is that should magic be mixed with mentalism in a pure mentalist routine an act, I should say? Should we be introducing magic, or should they be mixed, or, you know what I'm saying?
Well, I know exactly what you're saying, because this is a discussion that seems to crop up with some frequency among mentalists. And there are people who feel very strongly that magic and mentalism should never be mixed. I don't think that's so, because I've seen examples where it can be mixed. Dunninger used to open many of his mentalism shows by doing a magic trick that was explicitly and overtly that.
Was that the linking rings?
He did do that, but what I'm thinking of specifically, he did a version of the egg bag with an oversized bag, and talking about how perceptions were kind of unleashed in the dark, and seances, and how strange things could happen, but they weren't always real. And he would show this large bag to be empty and then produce a glass of water from it. And it was basically an egg bag, except larger and given a theme of spiritualism, but not being presented as an actual ghostly manifestation, but rather a magic trick with a spooky theme. Conversely, Harry Blackstone Jr. used to include a couple of mentalism routines in his show, and it always fit together perfectly well. So the proclamation that you cannot or may not mix mentalism and magic is clearly not true, because I've seen it done successfully. Having said that, I also think it's not easy to mix magic and mentalism properly. So it's sort of...
So you're saying there's a proper way of doing it?
Well, I don't know if there's a proper way, but there are at least proper ways, plural. Okay. But I don't think you can just arbitrarily do it. If you grab a piece of magic and a piece of mentalism and try and make them coexist, it could work, but it's sort of like cooking. If you were to grab some random ingredients off the pantry shelf and mix them together, would they blend into a good taste?
Gotcha.
Maybe by accident they would. But I would think it's probably more frequent that they wouldn't conflict. And so if you're going to mix magic and mentalism, to me, the idea is not that you shouldn't do it. It's that if you want to do it, first of all, figure out why. And second of all, make it harmonious in some way. It can be done. But again, that doesn't mean it's easy.
Right. Right. Yep. It isn't easy, and I think that is one of the barriers of entry into mentalism in general, is because that it does require you to script and to talk, as opposed to having a trick that is a gimmick that is kind of self-working and it's going to go right and you just kind of figure out the way. But so I think there's a little bit more work that you have to do to be a mentalist as opposed to be a magician, and some people might argue with me on that.
I agree with you, but I would make further subdivisions. I think there are a bunch of different types of magic, and some of them are easier or more difficult than others. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what I consider to be the easiest type of magic to do well and the most difficult to do well.
Okay.
And mentalism is at neither extreme. I think the easiest type of magic to do well is manipulation.
Really?
That's, I know that sounds wrong when I first say it, but I'll explain why. Manipulation takes a lot of practice, much more so than most other types of magic.
Just like juggling.
But built into the technical aspect, built into learning how to manipulate those objects, is the performance, is the showmanship, is baked into the process. Not completely, but by the time you have learned how to multiply the balls or to produce the playing cards or to vanish the thimbles, whatever the thing may be, by the time you have learned the technical skill required, you're already very, very far along in understanding the rhythms of performance, the nature of displaying this to an audience. Mm-hmm. So the gap between having technically mastered the trick and being able to present the trick, that gap is actually very small.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
Whereas things that take less practice on a technical level, prop magic, to do a square circle, let's say, or some production item of that sort, the practice level, the technical achievement is relatively low, but that means you've got this huge gap between getting it to work and presenting it in a way that comes across as being magical. Mentalism, I would say, is further along in the spectrum on the difficult end of things, but it isn't the most difficult. I'll tell you what I've concluded is the most difficult based on years of thinking about this topic. My answer is big stage illusions, grand illusions. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say those are the most difficult types of magic to do well, and let's be clear, I'm talking about doing it well. I'm not talking about getting through it.
There's a big difference. I understand.
But to do it well, here's the challenge in big stage illusion. In most big illusion performance material, it is very clear to any thinking audience that the primary source of the magic is the box, the prop. The secondary source is the assistant or assistants.
Right.
And so the magician is at best the tertiary source of the magic.
Agreed.
And so the great challenge of large-scale illusions is to convince the audience, in spite of obvious evidence to the contrary, that if the magician were to walk off stage, nothing would work.
Right.
So that's a hell of a challenge. And when it's done properly, I mean, good large-scale illusion is thrillingly good. But it's hard, and it's much harder than I think most magicians give it credit for being.
I understand what you're saying. I'm thinking, for an example, like Franz Ferrari or David Copperfield, whenever that they're making something large disappear, and they go, now! I mean, but they have built this up to the point where that they actually do it, that you believe that no other person, the assistant, couldn't say now the way they do or something, you know?
If they have been led into that belief, then it's going to work. And if they haven't led into the belief, then it's like watching a little kid gesture at the television set and say, change. And the image on the TV set changes. And you don't look at the kid and say, how did you do that?
Right.
You look at the kid and say, isn't that cute? And so I have seen illusionists who are more like the kid in front of the television than like a grand illusionist making something happen.
Well, that would lead me to the question then about people like Dante and Thurston and Blackstone and others who I would refer to as boxmen. They had large illusions. And as you said, the boxes and the assistants are doing the work, but he's the one that takes the credit. And if they walk off the stage, no one else can do it. As you just said, the magician is responsible for the magic taking place.
Right.
What is that it factor you think that made them the magician?
I'm not sure that's something that can be boiled down into words. Certainly there are certain performers whose personality was so dynamic. I mean, the one that immediately comes to mind is Ricciardi.
Of course. Wow. Yeah. That's great. Who
was doing mid-sized illusions. Most of what he did was not gargantuan, but he was so physically dynamic.
Wow.
This wonderful cross between a toreador and a flamenco dancer.
Good analogy.
And there was never any question that he was the center of any magical effect. It was coming from him, whether he physically touched it or not. So that's a pretty obvious solution in his case. But then there are other people. It's hard to clarify. How did Siegfried and Roy, and particularly Siegfried, managed to convince an audience that everything was happening through their presence when they were surrounded by a show that had 90 dancers to start with and gargantuan props and illusions and huge set pieces that would move and change, one of the most advanced lighting setups in the history of theater. And the answer is when Siegfried and Roy first debuted their final show, the one at the Mirage, I caught it in the first month or so. And the show itself was amazing, and it hadn't fully gelled yet. And to be honest, I think Siegfried and Roy were a bit overwhelmed. By how big the show was. And after the performance I saw, there was a gathering in their quite large dressing room, their area to greet people. This was tied to one of the Joe Stevens conventions, so all the VIPs, so-called, were invited to this after party. And Jay Marshall was there, and Siegfried came into the room, and he was kind of working the room. He was making the rounds, saying right. hello to people. And, of course, everybody was lavishing tremendous praise on him, as they should have. The show was extraordinary. And when they got to Jay Marshall, and I was standing a couple of feet away, Siegfried came over, and instead of saying, what a great accomplishment, Jay said, the show is really astonishing. I want to come back and see it in a few months when you're on top of it. That's not word for word.
Yeah, but I can imagine Siegfried going, what?
And Siegfried just got furious.
Yeah.
And neither one of them was wrong or right. I mean, Jay's observation was factual. They were kind of overwhelmed by the show. On the other hand, this was such a glorious accomplishment. The show was brand new, and it wasn't particularly, wasn't very nice to in that moment, in that situation, bring up a criticism. So I'm not on either side of this story. I'm just recounting it because I was there.
This might have been the wrong timing for him to have said that.
Yes, but the fact is I did see the show, well, many more times, but the next time I saw the show was at least a couple of months later. And nothing in the show had changed particularly as far as all of the giant props and sets and dancers and choreography and lighting and all of that was the same. And yet somehow now Siegfried and Roy dominated that show and had a presence that made you know if they walked off, everything would stop. And I can't fully define how they achieved that. You know, words like charisma, are very hard to analyze, star quality. There's no question that Siegfried and Roy very much had charisma and star quality. But there was something changed as they got to know the show better. You know, when a show opens, particularly one that is so huge and has so many moving parts, it can take a while. I have a theater show that's just me. I mean, there's no set changing. There's no assistance. The tech is pretty minimal, and it took me quite a while to get this 2 hours to fit to kind of the pieces of it to fully fit together. It absolutely was not the case when I first began doing the show. So if it takes me a while to get on top of a show that is only me,
right?
I can barely conceive of how to get that to work in a show that is that big and elaborate.
Well, that's a good point. I recall that of all the gargantuan illusions and everything around the accoutrement around Siegfried and Roy, it was overwhelming. And yet when Siegfried would do a dove routine, I mean, they were producing dragons and things. And then when he would do doves, they were still oohing and ahhing. It's like, this is
phenomenal. Actually, it's interesting that you remember the doves. The doves weren't in the Mirage show. That was when he finally stopped doing the doves. The dove act, which was a Channing Pollock style of act, is something, it's essentially what Siegfried started with when he became the stage
on cruise ships way back when.
On the SS Bremen. And, people forget it was a great act. He was a really good dub worker with his own style and slightly different and therefore original techniques. And I would put his original dub act that he started with up against Lance Burton or Johnny Thompson or Shimada. I mean, he was in that same class of people who in the wake of Johnny Thompson, and before Johnny, obviously Channing Pollock, and now the this sort of newer generation came along, And Siegfried was just somewhere in the middle of that mix. And his Dove Act was terrific. And when they expanded into doing illusions, he and Roy, the Dove Act was compressed into, you know, a minute and a half or something, mm-hmm. as the opening of the big illusion act. He would come out and do a compressed version of the Dove Act, and that would lead into the big illusions
right.
with the cats and so forth. Okay. Originally, that act was about 15 minutes long, gradually got closer to 20. And then when they left, they were in a show called Jubilee at what was then the MGM, today is Bally's.
Bally's, right.
They moved over to, let me see if I remember all of this. They moved over to the Stardust
yeah.
where they became the featured attraction in the Lido show.
Yeah.
Where they expanded to doing 25 and then 30 or so minutes, but still opening with that Dove sequence. Then they moved to the Frontier, where they had a show called Beyond Belief. It was the first time they had a show that was entirely theirs.
Just so. Mm-hmm.
And they still opened with that Dove segment. And it wasn't until they moved over to the Mirage in what became their biggest and final show that the Dove Act was finally removed from the equation. Oh. So that's been for a long time, and it was a great opening. It was strong.
Well, when you had consulted for them, what did you do for them as far as tightening their show or mentalism?
I actually don't know. My consulting for Siegfried and Roy, Siegfried at a certain point was looking to learn some mentalism that he could do not on stage but off stage. When greeting guests to that big backstage dressing room area and so forth. So I flew into Vegas and taught him a few things for that use. But also, I will say, and this was that was a formal arrangement where he hired me to do that.
Okay.
But also, after they closed at the Frontier, they went to Japan for 10 months. Where they opened an extraordinary show, which in some ways is my favorite of the various shows of theirs that I saw. I saw it three times over the course of those 10 months. They did it in, it was a gargantuan tent. And when you were inside it, you didn't even realize you were in a tent. You felt like you were in a theater.
Circus Tihani, you were in a big tent then too. That was an amazing show. It's kind of like
right.
that kind of a thing?
Or bigger? Yeah, except I think the tent was bigger.
Okay.
I only saw Tihani's show once, but Siegfried Roy's tent looked massive. And so they did the show in Tokyo for a run of 5 months or something, and then they moved it to Osaka for the rest of the 10-month run. And it was hugely successful with the media, with the public. And I got to see the show very early in the run. It was only a week or two, I think, into the run. And after the show, I was invited to come backstage, and Siegfried sat down with me and said, tell me everything you didn't like. Tell me all the, I don't need to hear all the good stuff.
Right.
Although obviously I think he was quite happy to hear the compliments.
Sure, of course.
But he said, do you have any notes? And the answer was yes. I had about three. Having to do with some technical things and also one piece of staging, which I pointed out, and I said, I think this is problematic. I'm deliberately avoiding telling you
of course.
What it was. But he nodded with serious.
He understood. Yeah.
And I saw the show again some months later, and sure enough, the staging had been changed to what I'd suggested.
That's great that he listened to you and took your advice.
To compliment myself, I say that because it shows that even someone at the top of his game, as Siegfried was at that time, was still open to hearing comments and listening. I mean, the issue is not that he agreed with what I said and put that change in, because he could have easily have listened and said that that's a sensible comment, and I don't agree. And I wouldn't have felt slighted in any way. But the point is, he was open to hearing input about this remarkable show, whereas I think many performers would have said, what are you talking about? I don't want to hear anything, any issues here. I'm done. We're running.
That's an amazing story and a piece of advice that I don't know that people realize what you've just said there, because that you've got a very cogent point of saying that some people will not take advice because they are at a certain level, or they feel like they've been doing the show long enough. It's like, you don't understand what my artistic vision is here, and are just discounting what you're saying. At that point, you say, okay, well, fine, you know. But yes, for them to be that level of professionalism and been doing it for so long, to be open and still listening.
Well, I try not to give advice unless it's asked for. Mm. If I see a magician perform, wherever it may be, it is not infrequent that after the show, if I have a chance to chat to the magician, they will say, do you have any notes? What didn't you like? What did you think? Or conversely, what did you think worked particularly well? And if that type of question is asked, then I will answer it, sometimes in a formal business arrangement and sometimes just in conversation.
Sure.
But if someone doesn't ask me for my feedback, I don't want to, you know, barge in and insist that they listen to my notes. One thing that magicians do, not all magicians, but a majority, they don't get directors.
Good point.
Magicians sort of out of necessity do it all themselves. They become become their own lighting people, their own wardrobe people, their own sound people, their
marketing,
own choreographers, marketing and everything else. And, you know, real performers don't. I mean, the ones who are big stars don't assume that they can do all the lighting themselves and design their own wardrobe and all of that. They bring in people who can bring specialized knowledge and who can see things that they can't. It's hard to direct yourself because you're in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
The theater show that I do, that I mentioned to you earlier, the earliest version of that show I did in 1988, and I directed the thing myself because I didn't have any other options. I didn't have the for a director. I didn't. And so I put this show together, and it came together reasonably well. But when I returned to the show, I did the show for off and on for some years, and then it sort of fell by the wayside. And I came back to the show in the early 2000s. So, you know, 15, 16 years later. And rethought the show radically, rewrote the show radically, and at that point hired a director. And it was the right thing to do.
He was a difference, I'm sure.
He was able to spot things structurally, in terms of blocking, in terms of some. He didn't micromanage. Or at least mostly he didn't. Maybe two lines that he said, you might want to think about taking those out. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't mostly that. It was mostly, you know, this would be a good place for us to put in a lighting change, and you could walk from that position to this position. And he was able to see that because he was sitting in the audience while we were running tech, and you know, to make those kinds of observations and to help me work on the structure of the piece. So I have been a director. I have directed other people in other shows. And so I've been on both sides of that equation. And I think, you know, not everyone can afford a director, either financially or in terms of the investment of time or in the letting go of certain kind of egotistical control. But those who can, if it's a good director, they obviously profit from it. I would like to think that the performers that I've directed have benefited from that.
Right.
You can't do it all yourself.
No, you can't and shouldn't try. I mean, most people think, well, I can do a little bit of that, or I've done this for a while, and so I should continue. But you're right. You need to have someone who has an objective view, and that if you can have someone who can be with you throughout the run of a show to direct and tweak everything because you're doing it over and over, as opposed to coming in and giving you just one time thing like Bob Fitch type of workshop. If you go and attend that, that's wonderful. But if you're actually doing a show, like you said, having a one-man show is going to be a month, 2, 3, 6 months or whatever, that if you can have somebody every day to say, you know, that if you just said this or tweak this, it'd be nice to have a director.
I'll tell you an anecdote, which happened yesterday.
Okay.
I was on a video chat with a friend, and I won't identify, you would know the name, but I won't identify the friend. But he was talking about an act that he's been working with, and he posted a video to me of a routine that this act was doing that he had been involved in creating and directing. And so while we were on the video conference, I watched this routine, which was a few minutes long. And I said to him, and this is all in real time, I watched and I said, I really like that. I mean, there's some visual moments that are really fresh and interesting. The trick itself was a very old trick, but with a fresh conceptual approach. I said, there's one line in there that I thought didn't belong. It kind of stuck out as not really fitting, and it wasn't necessary. And my friend laughed and said, yeah, I didn't write that part. That came, he's put that in recently.
Mm-hmm. Someone else had suggested that to him and he put it
in. No, I think the performer had figured on, had just thought, oh, I can do a line here.
Yeah.
And without going into detail about who the performer was or is, it was a kind of mild gag that served no real purpose except to deflect from the potential of it being a serious moment.
Gotcha. I understand.
I was afraid of it being a serious, I think the performer was afraid of it being a serious moment and put the gag in to be more comfortable, but in doing, did not help the routine.
When it really needed to have that serious moment for people to stay with.
Exactly.
I understand.
Well, magicians do this all the time. I have said on many occasions, and sometimes I'm quoted on this, that magicians are afraid of mystery. And by extension, they're afraid of magic. And the most obvious way that that manifests is with magicians who do what I refer to as winking. Now, sometimes it literally is winking the eye, but sometimes it's a line or a moment that accomplishes the same thing, which is, I think there are a lot of magicians who are afraid that if they acknowledge taking magic seriously, then the audience is going to ultimately reject them as being a nerd, someone who's hip.
I see.
And so by winking, whether it's literally winking or whether it's a little, you
aside.
Know, commentary gag or a facial take, or they find ways, and what they're really trying to express to the audience, whether they know it or not, is if I take this seriously, you're going to think that I'm a dweeb. So I have to get in there first and let you know that I don't take this seriously so that you'll agree with me that we're both very hip.
Right. I understand.
And as a result, the magic suffers. Now, that makes it sound like I'm against comedy magic, and I'm certainly not. But I'm against performers who are terrified of making a moment serious.
And creating mystery.
Yeah. Magicians tend to think that if the audience is not actively applauding or laughing, then something must be wrong. And the reality is that, you know, think of the last time you went to a movie or a play, assuming it wasn't a laugh-a-minute comedy style. There were probably long segments where the audience was silent. The only sound was popcorn if it was in a movie theater.
Right.
You know, I mean, a dramatic performance is not about exciting the audience into applause and laughter every moment. Now, it's not identical if you're performing in a nightclub, let's say, or at a banquet or something. The number of laughs per hour, the number of applause breaks per hour or per minute, it may be different depending on the circumstance, depending on the framing, depending on who you are. I'm not against applause or laughter. I would like to think I get my fair share in performance, but the notion that that those are the only reactions an audience can have in order to convey that you're going over, I just think that's narrow thinking.
But you agree that there should be something perhaps that could break the moment. I mean, first of all, let the mystery happen, but there should be moments perhaps to break the seriousness. I'm thinking of movies, like you said, there'll be a long time, and then there'll
But this is, I mean, these are choices.
Yeah.
You know, obviously there are movies more so than theater movies are controlled experiences. I'd say even more so than theater, because movies have more tools to work with.
I'm thinking like James Bond, for an example, in all the Bond movies that he'll have some sort of a glib type of a thing after he had just killed someone or knocked someone over or whatever.
Yeah, but we also know that after a while that became tedious.
That's true. Yeah.
You know, in the early Connery Bonds, those were just daring jokes.
Right.
To have this sort of matching up of a horribly violent moment with a glib throwaway line was kind of shocking in a way that at the time was kind of new.
Yes.
When you move into the Roger Moore Bond movies,
it was just silly.
They just increasingly silly, and those lines became increasingly pointless.
Good.
And when they moved past that, they went with the Timothy Dalton Bond. They went very grim and serious.
Mm-hmm.
You could say that they overcorrected.
Yep. Good.
That, and the audience, the box office response indicated that the audience agreed.
Yeah.
You know, and then eventually, you know, when the current, I mean, there's about to be the last of the currents.
Yeah, Daniel Craig.
And then we'll find out where the whole franchise goes from there. But the current version of the Bond films with Daniel Craig, they've hit a very interesting new mix. That yes, there are still glib lines, but
not as many. He uses them seasoning, you know, for
first the Daniel Craig movies, Bond movies, opens with this completely serious and violent scene with that flashback into the fight in the bathroom. If you remember
it was Casino Royale, wasn't it? His first
shockingly serious.
Mm-hmm.
There's no laugh lines in that. There's no glib asides. It's two people trying to kill each other. And that opening scene tells you, it told the audience, okay, this is not what you're used to. We're remixing the formula and the proportions are going to change. And I thought it was a terrific evolution.
So likewise, bring that in back to magic and mentalism and performing in your act, that you're going to be actually having something that's like that. So this way that you shake up the audience almost immediately, it's like, well, this wasn't what I was expecting. I thought this was going to be some, like you said, nerdy kind of a thing. For an example, like Jason Alexander would open to begin with when he would come out, expecting people are going to laugh because he is who he is. But he did the John Allen thing. So he has a card in the mouth, basically. So he's doing a silent act for the first minute. And then there's a powerful magic moment. I just like the thinking of that.
Well, Jason's parlor act, which I was lucky enough to see, and which very much deserved the award. You know, he was voted Parlor Magician of the Year.
Right.
And that wasn't just people responding to a big television star performing for a week in the Magic Castle, it was because he put together a terrific act that he worked through very, very meticulously, and dealing with how to get the audience away from, oh, it's George from Seinfeld, and into the idea that he was a magician, that was very carefully planned, and it worked very, very well. When I saw Jason perform in the parlor, I went up to him afterwards and said, you know, if you were willing to take a huge reduction in in income, you could do this professionally.
Right. I recall that might have been the year that at Mindvention that you had received the reward, coming full circle back to what we were talking about, in which Jason Alexander had performed. Were you there that year?
I was not there that year. Okay. I mean, I know Jason and have seen him perform more than the in the parlor. And we've had some very good discussions. He's a very bright guy. I don't know if I've had a chance to chat with him. But
I have. And he is very interesting.
You know, magic for him is not it's not a casual interest. Mm-hmm. Magic is one of his entryways into show business in the first place.
Right.
And he still regards it with serious intent.
Like Neil Patrick Harris, there was someone who had an interest in magic and continues.
That was Neil's entry into show business also. Yeah, mm-hmm. It was the Magic Castle Junior program.
Right. I want to go into something just a minute that actually could take a lot of time, and I don't want to spend too much time. I want to wrap this up soon, but we could go on for much longer. But that has to do with just your creativity about coming up not just with the ideas that eventually will become manuscripts and then books and or monographs or whatever. When you're coming up with an idea, is it something that you have been inspired by from some reading from some of the early books? I assume that you must read a half dozen, but my wife used to read 5 books a week. She was an avid reader and mostly romance. I don't know if you read fiction or mystery or what is your favorite type of what type of books do you like to read?
Well,
outside of magic?
I read a fair amount of nonfiction, books about history, biographies, or books that try to frame a certain period of time in a particular subculture or what have you. So I do a lot of that and various other topics, psychology, linguistics, mathematics. There are a number of things that catch my attention. When I do read fiction these days, I tend to go with well-written thrillers.
John Grisham kind of a thing. James Patterson.
I'm very fond. I don't read either of the authors you just mentioned, but yes, I'm very fond of Lee Child.
Oh yes,
John Leacher books.
Yeah, they read them all.
Really well written, well plotted.
Yeah.
And then there's
horrible choice of Tom Cruise, by the way, for the movies. Horrible.
Surprisingly, I mean, I don't disagree with you because the Jack Reacher character is 6'5", and Tom Cruise is my height, which is about 5'7", or less. I'm actually barely 5'7", and I think Tom Cruise is just about the same height. So how does that work? You know, there was a similar thing of casting with the character of Wolverine.
Mm-hmm. Hugh Jackman.
In the comic books, Wolverine is like 5'3" or something, and Hugh Jackman is like 6'5", something like that. And there was a project a couple of years ago, there was talk about doing a Houdini musical, which got fairly far along before it collapsed, that was meant to star Hugh Jackman. And again, it's this, I think Hugh Jackman is great.
Yeah, of course.
It's this very tall actor playing Houdini in real life was maybe 5'4".
It was like Adrian Brody playing Houdini. That didn't make sense.
So the Tom Cruise casting was kind of ludicrous. Having said that, I think the two movies that have come out thus far of the Jack Reacher character, if you're willing to just ignore the fact that he's physically wrong,
still a good movie.
Yeah. Actually, pretty good movies. They're enjoyable.
Didn't want to get off on a tangent. Sorry.
That's all right. But when I read fiction, it tends to be again well-written thrillers. just because I really want to read to. It's escapism. It's getting away from. I tend to read those when I'm traveling. So if I'm sitting on an airplane for a long time, or I'm stuck in an airport or a hotel room. Mm-hmm.
You consider yourself a speed reader?
It depends on what I'm reading. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've never done a speed reading course. There are methods that are taught.
Right.
But I'm perfectly capable of skimming if something warrants that. And many magic books warrant skimming, I would say. But I do read a lot. But this has now kind of gotten away from your initial question.
How do
I go about being creative?
Correct.
And this is something I have addressed before. So I think I've got a decent answer, although it might not be a satisfactory answer. The simplest way to put it, and I promise I'll explain what I mean, but the simplest way to condense it all down is, if you want to be creative, be creative. Now, that sounds like a silly tautology, but
it's like if you want to be a writer, you need to write.
Exactly. So the image that I always go back to is, you know, sometimes it's like on a farm, there'll be a pump that connects underground mm-hmm. to a water well or something. Yeah. But the pump is the old style. There's a handle. Mm-hmm. And here I'm gesturing to you, even though people are only listening to this. But there's a handle that you move up and down.
Correct.
Right. And that causes the water to flow. Mm-hmm. Right. However, the first few times you move that handle up and down, no water comes.
Right.
You need to build up the hydraulic condition.
Or prime it somehow.
Oh, well, priming the pump is what I thought that process was called. And a few years ago, I discovered that actually priming the pump has a slightly different meaning. Hmm. So I'm not going to use that phrase. But yes, that's what you're thinking I mean is what I mean.
Okay.
That when you start moving that handle up and down, the water doesn't immediately flow. You have to put some effort into it to get the flow to happen. I can guarantee what won't work. If you sit down next to that pump and say, gosh, I'm thirsty, you're not going to get the water.
Very good. Good point.
You need to put in that effort. And it may not produce the water instantly, but it won't take that long until the flow happens. And when the flow happens, you can actually do something. So I have found over many years that the best way that I can become creative is by pushing myself to be creative in the same way as pumping that handle up and down, moving it up and down. And I don't have a single way of doing that. Anything can be the starting point for inventing a magic trick, or at least that's the case for me. I may learn of a gimmick or a technique or a move and say, wow, what can I do with this? I may come upon a storyline, either some notion that I have, or perhaps I've read a book or seen a movie or watched a TV show that touched upon something, and I say, hang on, if that were turned inside out, there could be a magic trick there.
Yeah.
So it might start with a phrase or a concept. It might start with a technical method. The method may come full blown first, or the effect may come full blown first, or they may develop in tandem. Sometimes, of course, it's because I've seen a trick that someone else published, and I say, I wonder if there might be a better way to do that, or at least a way that fits me more accurately.
Yeah, I just recently bought and downloaded your Manhattan Transfer, for an example. And you were talking about that in the explanation about going back to 1935 or something. I mean, in different books and how that came about, and it's brilliant.
So you know, all of these are viable doors in which through which you can enter into the creative process.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the significant thing is that you decide to push yourself to do that. And if that's the case, then in time, and it may not happen in a matter of moments, it may take a longer time, but at some point when you are pushing yourself to try to be creative, it's going to start flowing like the water from that pump. And then when it flows, now it's up to you to figure out what to do with that flow. What right. type of container, what vessel is that water going to fill and take the shape of that container? And this analogy is going to get more and more awkward, so I'll stop. But you understand my point. So, yes. So I don't think there's a single way to approach creativity, at least for me, there's not. I know there are people who wish there was a simple formula. If such a formula exists, I've never encountered it. But again, I'll boil it all back down to, if you want to be creative, be creative.
Well, it seems like that I'd heard, I want to say Jeff McBride may have said this, and that is, in order to be creative, that you should exercise creativity and originality. It is not something people are necessarily born with. Yes, I mean, there are people who are great singers or writers or pianists or whatever, musicians, and or comedians or whatever, and you think, well, they have an innate ability. Perhaps they were born that way. Well, I think, as Jeff had said, that we're all creative. You just need to exercise that muscle. It's a muscle that we all have that we may not use.
Agreed. I don't know that everybody has the identical.
Oh, sure.
The identical talent or the identical innate ability. But I do know that working on it makes it better. Yes. Let's move to a different type of skill. There are people who have musical ability. That seems to be something people are born with. Mm-hmm. So there are people who are born with perfect pitch, who understand music, rhythm, harmony on a very innate level. Mm-hmm. And go into the pursuit of music. But imagine that there are two people and one of them has, for want of a better phrase, a grade A musical ability and the other has a grade B musical ability. But the person with the grade A musical ability doesn't bother to do anything with it. And the person with grade B musical ability pursues it. Studies, not necessarily formal music training, that's one way to go about it, but the study might be just in the form of making music, of just producing music. So after the years go by and you look at those two people, the one who never pursued anything, even though innately he or she might have that grade A ability, is not going to be a good musician. And the one with the grade B level of musical ability, but who really pursued it and found something that clicked, found a style of music that spoke to them and that they could try and take somewhere. There's your right. terrific musician. Now, we're very lucky that obviously there are some people in our lives who are grade A musicians when it comes to their innate ability, but who've also pushed it willfully. And the results are, that's what we hopefully mostly listen to.
There are a lot of people who have a lot of really good skills, and I was always surprised whenever, for an example, I've been to Nashville, and you go into a bar and you hear some band playing, and you think, who are these people? I've never heard of them before. They're in the right place to be discovered, is apparently what they're trying to do. And I'm thinking, this is better than this other guy, or actors, for an example. Why do people happen to be more well-known than others when I think that their abilities are less than somebody's? Anyhow, it's all subjective, I'm sure, too.
Yes.
Being in the right place at the right time and having an agent, et cetera.
That for all the importance of talent, and there is a great deal of importance there, and for all of the importance of working on it, of pushing your ability further, a lot of it comes down to just dumb luck.
That's
being
true.
In the right place at the right time, that is an ingredient, and that may seem unfair. But life doesn't work on the basis of what's fair or not. Life works on the basis of here's the particular set of circumstances that came together on that particular day or that particular year that turned this person's life in that direction.
Right. Well, as we start to close over here, I just wanted to say also that I've enjoyed our friendship and that I've known you since the early 80s, whenever that years ago, I want to say 81, 2 or 3, somewhere in there, that I lived in Midland, Texas, in West Texas, and surely don't remember this, but I had hired you to come out to West Texas and performed for an organization that I was a president of. And that would have been the Natural Gas Association of the Permian Basin. I know. And you were working with Tobias Beckwith at the time. I contacted Tobias, and then I ended up contacting you. And then anyhow, you came out to do the show, and there was something what was it? Someone just said, you asked, what is someone's name? And let's say it was Ben. But because of the West Texas accent, it's like Bayon. And you said, but, you know, only here we have, you know, that a three-letter word would have, two syllables, you know, Bayon instead of Ben or something. I just thought that was kind of funny.
I'll be honest, God, I don't remember that moment, but it is the kind of thing I would do that I would say. Partly because I try very hard with my work to, as the expression goes, to be in the moment.
Sure, of course.
You know, I'm doing interactive performance. As I've often observed, if I were to stand on stage and read my own mind, it wouldn't be interesting to most people. So it's all interactive. It all involves the audience. And it's one of the things that makes a live show exciting, is that if the audience is able to realize that this show has never happened before in exactly this way, it's live. And
that's art.
That's what makes any live show exhilarating in a way. I said earlier that movies have a power to manipulate audiences beyond what a live show, a stage show can do. I'll stand behind that statement, but that doesn't mean that movies are better than stage shows. Mm-hmm. And there are things about a live show that a movie or a television camera, even live video, cannot be as powerful as a live performance that's right there, because the audience is alert to the fact that because it's a live show, something could happen that was completely unintended, that was completely unexpected. And it could be something great or it could be something tragic.
Sure.
And that gives a vitality to live performance that is never going to come across a screen. So one of the things that I'm constantly doing in my live performing is trying to seize any opportunity. So if someone, for example, you described someone pronouncing their name with a kind of drawl, and I'm sure I would have said something like what you recall of managed to get two syllables out of a three-letter name, or that's an interesting diphthong, or there are all sorts of things I might have said, but it doesn't at all surprise me to hear that I found something to say rather than simply acknowledging the person's name and moving on.
Right. Well, that was, again, something that was, what would that have been, 40 years ago nearly?
Remember that over all this time, then I must have done something. Something right, yeah.
Well, you'd also signed autographed a black and white photo, which hung on my wall for a number of years, and I'm going to dig that out, and so I'm going to post that on the blog, so that way people can go back and see that picture of early Max Maven with your hands crossed and the boo look kind of thing from back then.
Pretty sure I know what photograph that is, which would date the photo to 1984.
Okay, there we go.
If it's the photo I'm thinking of with my arms crossed, and it's a publicity shot, then that photo came out in 84, which helps to
narrow down the
timing of the show in Midland.
Which leads me then to ask a question. How many ties do you have in your closet? I'm talking,
I think I own two usable.
Are they black?
One is black on black, and the other is, I'm picturing what's in my closet. The other one is black and white striping. Mm-hmm. But I very rarely wear ties anymore.
No, few people do.
First of all, social customs have changed. And secondly, when I am at a place such as the Magic Castle, where men are required to wear jackets and ties, you are allowed to wear a banded collar, according to the Magic Castle dress code.
So that's what you wear.
Lots of shirts. I'm wearing one now. Lots of shirts that have banded collars. And so that's what I'm most likely going to wear. But I don't even wear suits very often.
Do you have anything of color in your closet?
Do I have anything of color in my closet? The simple answer is no.
Okay.
I do have some things that have white or gray.
Okay.
But very few of those. And I guess technically those aren't really part of the color.
The color palette.
Yeah.
Just different shades of black.
Yep.
Very good. Well, as we close, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast. So I would like to close then by asking, what is your phrase? What is it that is your philosophy of life? It's not just a word, but it could be a sentence, a phrase, or something that is important to you that you live by that gives you energy to wake up every morning.
Man, that's a hell of a request at short notice. I'll give you a phrase. It's not my philosophy of life, but you'll understand why it's an important phrase to me. Mm-hmm. I'll give you my definition of magic.
Excellent.
Which took me decades to work out. You know, here's this thing that we're all so passionate about. We spend huge proportions of our lives exploring, learning, performing magic, and yet what is magic? And it took me a very long time to come up with what I think is a working definition, at least for me, and the most succinct I've been able to come up with. Magic, in the theatrical sense, magic is the aesthetic exploration of mystery.
I like that. Good definition.
That's as succinct as I've managed to put it.
Yeah, that is, again, a topic which we can go down, because I have philosophy on what my thoughts are on the definition of magic as well, and I'm sure others do as well. But we'll leave it there for now. Thank you, Max, so very much for
it's
your time.
It's my pleasure, Scott. Nice talking with you.
It's been a pleasure. So with the Magic Word Podcast, that was Max Maven. This is Scotty out. Wow, that was great. Thank you, Max, very much for sharing your thoughts with us here this week. And as you listeners can tell, we could have gone on much longer with this conversation easily, as Max is just a well full of knowledge and advice and history and, gosh, you name it. So thanks. Thanks for these few moments we've had together to share with the rest of the listeners. This has been just fantastic. And what a way to kick off the next 600 episodes that we will have of the Magic Word Podcast. This is great having you, Max, as our featured guest for the 600th episode, and look forward to having as many, many more into the future. And as we have magic conventions, I'll be attending those and also meeting and greeting all of you listeners out there and talking with you and maybe featuring some of you on this podcast in the future. Also, a couple of weeks ago, we did have a contest that was running for a free registration for the Atlanta Harvest of Magic convention coming up in Atlanta, Georgia in late September, early October. And we pulled out a winner's name of Joe Miller. Unfortunately, the email that Joe had given us was not a valid email address. So Joe, if you're listening, please send another email that is valid to scott@themagicwordpodcast.com. Or if any of you listeners happen to know Joe Miller, who is the one who had registered for this contest, you might contact him and let him know that he had won and for him to contact me and give me his right address. I'm going to give it another week, and if I haven't heard back from him or any listener telling me how to get in touch with him, I'm going to draw another random name for the winner of that contest. Well, we, again, have many more people lined up over the next few weeks, and I look forward to having you back here and listening to us. Be sure to subscribe to our pod letter when you go to the Magic Word Podcast. There you can see how you can join us there. And of course, I always encourage you to leave us a 5-star rating and some nice comments, if you will, please, on iTunes. It's an easy thing to do and will only take a few minutes of your time. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember that if magic is the aesthetic exploration of mystery, then my advice would be to never give up on exploring,
and you may find real magic. This is Scotty out.